Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
Today's episode, In Trumpism We Trust. In our deep dive today, Trump's effect on American Christianity. As President Trump recedes into history, has Trumpism emerged as a new religion? Or have we exaggerated strong political opinion into worship? And in our Courage or Cringe segment, the Premier League versus BLM, Cuomo brother chaos, and racist mathematics. Is the appearance of black footballers against BLM an oddity or indicative of things to come? Do the Cuomo brothers owe us an apology for recent lacks of transparency, or do we owe them more understanding given the circumstances of COVID? And finally, are geometry, algebra, and trig systematically racist? Or have we applied social constructs to natural sciences? This and much more on this episode of TDR. Jesus?
Charlie?
We're back.
We are.
We're talking about breathing problems. I have one. Some weird thing that I catch myself listening to the podcast and realizing that I can hear myself when I breathe, when I inhale more than I can when I talk sometimes.
Right.
So now I'm trying to be very conscious of that. It's amazing the things you learn when you're doing.
But the more conscious you become, the more you try to control it, the worse it gets.
Do you remember one of the very early viral videos on YouTube, Chocolate Rain? Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
This was monster, hundreds of millions of views, but really early on, Charlie Bit My Finger kind of days.
Right. I remember that.
And it was a kid who was recording a song that was, God bless him, it was terrible. It was a terrible song.
Oh, yeah.
But remember, he would talk, he would put the little subtitles on the bottom where it's like, I turn away from the mic so you can't hear me breathe in. Do you remember this?
I don't remember that part, but I do remember the little kid.
Literally, he was singing it and he would go like this. He'd back up so you couldn't hear him breathe in instead of coming close to the microphone. Anyway, I was thinking about him as we were prepping for this. Because
now we understand. Now we understand.
Hey, man, it's all about the gain and the breathing, and we're figuring all that stuff out here on TDR. But anyway, lots of interesting questions today. Yeah. It's an interesting deep dive too, because we don't often take head on a subject so sort of religiously, I guess, connected.
Right.
But it is very timely.
It's super timely. And frankly, when I first saw the headline and started reading the article, I immediately wanted to talk to you about it. Mm-hmm. And you, as you know, you're very open to this, of course, as someone that's very religious. I just wanted to get your take on at least some of the themes that were coming up in this piece. And it is just a very interesting idea, the whole sort of intersection between faith and the political system and really what has transpired over whatever X number of years. But it does feel like we're in a very different moment in terms of how people both view their faith and how their views of their faith apply to their own political ideology and to the degree that people support folks that they feel that sort of follow the same kind of belief. And mm-hmm. I think in the case of President Trump or former President Trump, it's pretty reflective there, and I think that's where this kind of all came from. We wanted to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm looking forward to it, and we should probably just dive in and get started.
Yeah, let's get started. So there was an opinion piece that came out in The Atlantic about a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago, that was labeled Betraying Your Church and Your Party. So just the headline alone, that's going to be interesting. But it talked about how Representative Adam Kinzinger, who is an evangelical Republican out of Illinois, mm-hmm. had decided to vote for impeachment. Now, he was one of the 10 representatives that were basically that decided to go along with the Democrats in voting to impeach former President Trump. Mm-hmm. And by the way, as part of that, he kind of also started calling out his own church, right? Now, the piece described him as neither a pastor or theologian, also knowing that his job is not to preach the gospel but to represent his constituents, but clearly thinks about his role as a Christian in politics and how mm-hmm. he can reach people who are thinking about eternal life. So that by itself was kind of an interesting, hearing that publicly, right? Which led him to conclude that his faith and his party had been poisoned by the same conspiracy theories and lies culminating in the falsehood that the election was stolen. And he went on to say, and I quote, "The reputation of Christianity today versus 5 years ago, I feel very comfortable saying it's a lot worse. Boy, I think we have lost a lot of our moral authority." Mm-hmm. Now, part of that comes from at least his belief in what the article talked about, in how Trump loyalists have actually helped shape that point of view, the reputation of Christianity, as being the ones that basically are driving that loss in moral authority, right? And in according to the article, he sees that there, and I quote, there are many people that have made America their God, that have made the economy their God, and have made Donald Trump their God, and that have made their political identity their God. He then goes on to say, I believe there is a huge burden now on Christian leaders, mm-hmm. especially those who entertain the conspiracies to lead the flock back into the truth. So I'll pause there. I mean, this whole idea about the role that Christianity sort of played in supporting sort of this Trumpism, and especially as it relates to evangelical Christians, of which, and I went back and looked at the data, at least some of the exit polls said that that anywhere between, I think, 76 to 81% of those that were both white and evangelical Christians supported former President Trump, right? Yeah. Which is a pretty over index. I know we've talked about here quite a bit as it relates to African Americans, how much they index, of course, supporting Democrats. But this is, we hadn't really sort of touched upon this, but there is a sort of very tight correlation between that particular part of the faith, evangelical Christians, and support for Trump. I think, and in part, you know, part of the reason, at least I think before, I remember hearing as to why Pence was actually chosen to be able to speak directly to that group. And the question comes is not as, especially what has happened with former President Trump since the election and during this whole push about trying to overturn the results, as people continue to double down on their support, do you see in any way, is the faith in any way being pulled down by that same kind of efforts and that same kind of ideology that just refuses to believe the truth? And to what extent it becomes now a sort of new branch, a new form of Trumpism?
Sure.
But now that it's very, you know, very much woven with Christianity, at least with that type of Christianity.
I think so much of it here is just based on, some people would view as strategic in how Trump associated himself with evangelical Christianity. Other people would say that's just his natural inclination. It's his actual belief. But in any case, ultimately, he was so supportive in policy and in word of, a lot of topics and policy and subjects that are favorable to people of belief, especially the evangelical quadrant has always been a very solidly conservative, reliable quadrant, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at other religious landscapes, the Catholic one is an example. I'm Catholic, as you know, Jesus. And like the Catholic landscape, nowhere near as reliably conservative mm-hmm. as the evangelical one. In fact, it's probably a 50-50, if that. So a lot of it is just tied to that I think that the evangelical community in particular saw in Trump someone who was talking about traditional family, talking about, being pro-life, really and not just in word, but in deed, right? I mean, just a lot of the things that he did, especially on the pro-life side, I mean, scores of things that he took action on, some of which are maybe even politically neutral, some may be politically damaging, right? So, or at least a nuisance you don't have to deal with.
To clarify, when you say indeed, mm-hmm. it definitely, I think it's true as it relates to once he was president, some mm-hmm. of the actions that he took. I think the part where people immediately sort of had issue with how much they were being, especially folks that were very religious supporting Trump, mm-hmm. was that based on who he was prior to even becoming president, some of his own personal.
Well, for sure, yeah.
He's still getting a lot of support.
He was a Democrat. He was a Democrat before, and he was pro-choice. And he, to the extent that I've dug into this, he seems to have had a fairly authentic, a change of heart on the issue of abortion. He says he claims that it was, to a family member who was pregnant, or I'm sorry, not family, a friend of the family who was pregnant and then considered an abortion, then decided against it. And then the person, the child that was born eventually grew up into this amazing young man. And so he was very impressed by that whole process and therefore he became pro-life. So I agree. None of his past life before the presidency would be indicative of that kind of position. But anyway, my point is not to kind of replay the presidency of Donald Trump, but only to say that I think a lot of the people, A, being so supportive of him on the evangelical right, and also being so, sort of want to let go of that support is driven by the fact of how strongly they felt that he supported some of the things that they cared right. about. I think that's like the sort of beginning part of why this had such an effect and why it's still in some sectors has held on for so long, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I guess part of the question here, this is what this piece is really speaking to, is as his presidency concluded and mm-hmm. the level of sort of nonsense kind of went even like further down, like down the tube, to the degree to that folks that were loyal to him basically want to remain loyal in spite of what then starts to feel that in some ways contradictory to some of those same beliefs that make some of these, you know, folks, you know, very Christian to begin with. Sure. And I think that's, if I'm reading a little bit between the lines, but frankly, kind of what exactly what Representative Kinsinger is saying is that his concern is that that Trumpism has now led to actually dragging down the faith.
Mm-hmm. I think he's right.
I think that's actually a really interesting point,
sure.
You know?
I think he's right about a lot of stuff. I think it would require us to have a much longer podcast than we do today to get into the real weeds of a lot of this stuff, because even the idea of the church is a very broad sentiment that, you know, if you're talking about evangelical Christianity, there's hundreds, thousands, maybe even individual churches and, you know, different branches of Christianity that are represented by that. So it's not as easy as saying something like, you know, in the case of Catholicism, like, you know, those churches and bishops under the Pope of Francis, like that's an easy sort of distinction to make. It's got a body of knowledge that it teaches, and you can either like it or hate it very simply. In this case, we're talking about thousands of individual churches when we're talking about Protestantism or even evangelical Christianity.
Sure.
So it's difficult for me to say what the impact to the church has been or to Christianity broadly, because I'm not exactly sure. I think we'd have to de-average that. But there are some things that I think, you know, that he says that are actually very true, and especially when he talks about the fact that, you know, people have worshipped a political party or mm-hmm. have, you know, worshipped Trump or worshipped other things. Idolatry, there's no question there's that, and there has been that throughout all of this period of time. And that is definitely something that is directly against Christianity. You don't have idols mm-hmm. of anything or anyone besides God himself. So clearly agree with that. I also think that, you know, I agree with him when he talks about, you know, kind of this importance that, or the notion that, look, we're only here for a while, like for a limited time on earth. And all of these things are interesting and important, but really they're nothing compared to like the mm-hmm. things that are really eternal.
Sure.
And so therefore we should kind of focus on that and not get lost in the weeds. 100%, you know, agree with him on that. I don't know how much I disagree with any part of this article, except for I'm trying to tease out the writer or the author of this piece.
Right.
From what he may or may not have actually said.
Well, how about this? In the case where this is the one that I thought was really interesting.
Because there's a lot about the author's lack of Christian understanding that came out in this piece. So
yeah,
it was tough for me to.
There was definitely parts there where it wasn't entirely clear where the line was drawn. But the point that he makes about, and this mm-hmm. is based on a quote that he said,
sure.
right? Where he believes that there's a huge burden on Christian leaders specifically, right? Especially those who have entertained those conspiracies to actually lead people back to the truth. What is your thoughts there? Because I have seen a lot of folks that have been very supportive of President Trump while he was in office, even afterwards, and supported through the entire process. I mean, even now, still supportive of that process. And the question becomes, at what point do you – it's one thing to be for a certain political party, but if you get to the point where you really do think there may be actually some falsehood that are being spread,
of course.
You're contributing to that dynamic. How much – you know, what mm-hmm. burden do they have to bring people back? And how much are they actually contributing to further sort of taking away to some of that moral authority that the faith actually has by not doing that?
I think in some cases, it's a great deal. In other words, I think it depends on what that particular faith tradition said or supported or advanced during the Trump presidency that they either now have to reel back or change or whatever. I think it depends. And what I'm saying is it's very difficult to speak on behalf of all Christianity, even all
sure.
Protestantism in the United States, because it's so segmented and divided. It's not one thing. It's thousands of things. Let's break out a couple of just neat branches, and I'll speak on behalf of Catholicism as one, because, again, I'm a Catholic.
Sure.
In the case of the Catholic faith, you know, the Catholic faith has agreements with political parties and disagreements with political parties, and they make their points pretty clear. So they supported, as an example, President Trump in all of his pro-life activity and, you know, completely lambasted him on immigration issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would support things that are about sort of like climate change, and they would support also things that would be about, you know, maintaining the integrity of the traditional family. So they are – what I always say about Catholicism is you don't look left or right, you look up, because to define it through a political lens is actually very difficult to do, since it's all over the map in terms of our political understanding. Now, that's Catholicism. Let's look at something else like – again, evangelical Protestantism. And even that, let's break it out into other things. Are we talking about Calvary Chapel? Are we talking about like a Foursquare Baptist thing? Are we talking about some non-denominational branch? Mm-hmm. I have no idea what we're talking about, right? But if a leader latched their wagon to Donald Trump and said, in Trump we trust, and here's why, and attached all the sort of principles of scripture and other things and teaching to him, now that he's gone and now that we know the full story, or at least some portion of a fuller story, yeah, they have to recontextualize that for their flock. There's no question about it. So I just think it just really depends a great deal on who it is we're talking about.
The challenging part here is when you see those stats, those numbers, that 80%, give or take, that did vote for Trump, then it does, in many, we love to talk about nuance and obviously looking at different perspectives, but it does feel like a sort of a more homogeneous block that is in this case supported President Trump. I would love to actually see what that looked like in other elections, but I have to assume it's pretty high as well. I think part of the thing
it is very high, but I would also say, and not to say that it's simply about one issue, because it's not. But it is
that is my concern, by the way. Yeah. When it becomes about one issue, and I think the way you describe for the Catholic faith, because I know a lot of people that are Catholic, but that do vote both ways, right? A lot of Latinos are Catholic. They're very conservative in one way, but also very Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge here, I think, if you do start getting any one, you know, faith becoming too tied to one specific party, I think that is a concern for that party and for that faith as well, because then you kind of get stuck in, like, no matter how, you know, like you're in that of that camp no matter what. One of the points that was brought up in the piece that it talked about, and once again, this is another point where it's not entirely clear whether it's him saying it or the author, but some of the concerns that I guess comes across of what he sees as a growing disconnect between Republicans and millennials, right? And part of it is that he says, look, only a third identify themselves as Republican, meaning millennials, right? Only a third of them. And then more of them are non-religious than being part of any single religious group. So his concern is that it bothers him that some evangelical obsession with Trump may make it actually harder for younger people to find Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa, that by being sort of too tied in, that you're going to sort of lose out this younger generation. And the challenge, you know, when you look at and you and I have spent quite a bit of time actually looking at this issue, specifically for Catholics, but you look at Christianity in general, I looked at the stats, right? According to Pew, in the late 1970s, about 90%, give or take, of Americans considered themselves Christian. That number has dropped down to about 65%.
And there's led by the younger quadrants.
Right, and there's nothing to indicate at this moment that that's going to turn around anytime soon or it's going to get better. So it does become an interesting dynamic where if you have one party that becomes very sort of connected or identified sort of singularly through a specific faith, that in many ways it actually is going to make it less accessible to a lot of other people to want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And so, I think that's a really interesting point as well in this underlying topic.
There's a couple of things though, but and this goes to the earlier point that I was about to make, which is that one issue. It's not that there is one issue alone. There are multiple issues, but there is a prioritization of the issues for this block, at least in theory. We don't know because we don't have everybody in front of us from this group, but you can just based on what you said, they vote in this, they have the tendency to vote this way. And that issue is the issue of life, the issue of abortion. And again, whether you agree or disagree, the logic at least goes something like this. If we're not alive, the other rights don't matter. Mm-hmm. Therefore, before we discuss our rights in finance or military or tax brackets or minimum wages, let's agree that we should be alive. That's the logic.
Right.
So as a singular issue, if a candidate comes out and says, I am staunchly pro-life, then that is very attractive enough to take the rest of the things with you that represent that particular candidate because it's a preeminent issue. And in fact, in that case, the Catholic Church actually does agree with that sentiment that abortion is the preeminent issue among all the issues. So
it's just that people don't really behave that way. Right, because there's a lot of Catholics that are Democrats.
You're right.
So if they did, I think it would be a different dynamic.
Well, it may or may not. That doesn't mean, again, we need a much longer show. That doesn't mean that you can't in good conscience vote for someone who is pro-choice. You can, but there is, you know, there's a number of different things, discernment, well-formed conscience, a bunch of different things that's supposed to happen that doesn't happen in a lot of cases.
Right.
But my point is just to make the point that the reason that number is so high is because there's alignment on that issue, and then from that issue flow a lot of other things. So that's one. The other thing is in terms of, because I agree with you, I think it's bad that a political party and a faith be so intricately linked.
Right.
But I also don't think this stuff happens necessarily in a vacuum. And specific to the Republican Democrat divide, over the last 50, 60 years, the Democrat Party has aligned itself in a number of different ways with areas of you know, call it gender ideology. We talked about abortion, call it, you know, those things, as well as some alignment to, or more alignment now to big business, you know, media, sure, tech, that kind of stuff. And those things, at least viewed out through the platform of like this kind of working class Christianity, there's been some movement away from that from the party, right? So it's also like we can't forget that, because it's the Democrat Party today is not the same Democrat Party that was in 1970 when you just read that statistic. So I think both things can happen, that it's not a good thing that a faith or a religion be so closely wedded to a political party, and that the political parties have gone in different directions vis-a-vis that faith. I think both of those things can be true.
Yeah, also, yeah, but even to that point, even from a Republican standpoint, right, some of the principles of what traditionally was to be Republican, such as small government, go in direct contradiction to some of the other stances, like a pro-life stance. A pro-life stance is not a small government stance. It's a big government stance. Is you want the government to actually control across the board who can or cannot have abortions, right? So I agree with you, but I also think that there's cases like that, and you see it in both sides, where the things that are at least more traditional about the parties have kind of gone away. I mean, the reality, most things that we argue about in this political climate are not necessarily about the traditional stances that either one of these parties sort of tend to have about the individual, about individual rights. One of a more like sort of social construct, right? You still get some of that, but that's changed, you know, quite a bit.
Yeah. I understand the point that you just made there. I don't understand the point about a pro-life stance being a big government stance, because the issue is simply about recognizing that if there is a life, that we shouldn't destroy it because it's innocent, right?
The reason I say it's a big government stance is that you have the two polar extremes is you have all of decision making at the individual level and all the decision level
at the government level.
Mm-hmm. And to me, a pro-life stance is at the decision level, at the government level, not the individual level. So if it was at the individual level, then the individual person gets the chance to decide one way or another what they want to do, right? Which in essence makes it a pro-choice.
It makes it a pro-choice decision, I guess, to some extent.
As opposed you're not allowed to do this because of the rights of the baby, because of all the, and I get all that, right? But that then you're taking that right away from the individual at some point.
Right.
And then putting it at a government. So that's why I think those are actually contradictory from that standpoint.
Just so I understand the logic of your argument then. So would you say the same thing? And if the answer is yes, then I get it, I guess. Would you say the same thing that something like being against murder or bank robbery is also a big government thing?
Yeah, I think we talked about this one before. So okay. I think this all comes down to how you define hurting others that are not, in this case, where I make the distinction is that I consider an abortion something that happens within the body of another person.
Yeah.
And unless you're able to completely separate those two, unless in the moment we start literally incubating babies and they grow out on their own,
happens now.
Yeah, but it's not a general practice. The majority of people are born.
Yeah.
But you could obviously have artificial wombs and have that be created as completely separate, independent of the person, of the host body, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where I'm making the distinction, where I put the individual responsibility, the individual choice at the host body, the person that's actually holding the pregnancy. If those two were completely separated, then to me, I put it more in the same category that you're referring to, which is murder or anything else, or they're two completely separate entities.
Right. But even without discussing the argument of abortion, let's put abortion to the side. What I'm saying is your logic seems to be that because something, applies to other people, therefore it goes to the level of government centralization as opposed to individual responsibility. That's what I thought you were saying. So would the same apply to any other thing? Like, hey, I don't want my house to get broken into. Well, that's a big government thing because you have to pass a law that says it's wrong to break into somebody's house.
Yeah, and
if the answer is yes, then I guess you're being logical.
There are plenty. By the way, I'm not anti-big government. I mean, in many cases, I'm very liberal. So some of the things that I support, by definition, need to have government involvement. So I think there are plenty of things that require big government. The point I was trying to make simply is this, which is, as it relates to a fundamental Republican principle, which is around the individual rights,
sure,
I see that in contradiction with a pro-life stance, which ultimately ends up, in order for you to be able to enforce that, it has to be a big government, basically policy to make that happen.
Got it. Okay. So, I guess, from a traditional you know, conservative ideological standpoint, having individual personal rights does not divorce you from the common good. So,
correct.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so you can have your or a proclivity for individual rights. You want to have more of a bias on, hey, if we have to decide between the state or the federal or the individual, we would pick the individual. Mm-hmm. That does not mean that somebody says, oh, but everyone else be damned. Now, that is closer to libertarianism.
That is a very
libertarian
thought, I
right.
think. But it is, at least in theory, is more aligned to at least what historically has been the Republican Party. You know, what's interesting about this topic is that still the thing that I sort of, when I look at this, if you want to fast forward 20 years from now, if this trend continues as it relates to people considering themselves or practicing Christians, mm-hmm. what does that then mean for the Republican Party if it's too interlocked with some of the beliefs that are core to those Christian values, but that may be more and more at odds with how the majority of people sort of feel about certain social topics or topics in general?
Well, I think that's happened throughout history, that countries and civilizations have come in and out of a Christian understanding, and it could very well happen that Christianity across the board dies in this country. At the same time, in continents like Africa and Asia, Christianity is exploding. So it may be the natural global ebb and flow of religion in certain places. I mean, the answer is very clear. If the trends continue, it's very bad. It means a much smaller, much more, you know, less active, at least Christianity, for
right,
sure.
Right.
That's what the trend indicates.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just interesting to what degree that ends up, you know, getting captured within this sort of still very strong Trump movement that is there. I was reading a new polls from USA Today.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that I think of registered Republicans, still about half of them at this point would choose to leave the Republican Party to another alternate party if Trump was in charge of it. And to me, like, to hear that or to read that, it's just amazing the level of support that there still is. And even if by doing that, by the way, you kill the Republican Party, and good luck winning any election anytime again.
Sure.
But it does speak to this really strong stronghold. And I would think that at least this group that we're talking about, evangelical Christians, probably all will fall within that group. Because if push comes to shove, to your point,
it depends on
whether
you
agree with Trump or not. I mean, it feels like that sort of the more Christian issues seem to rank a lot higher, regardless of what else he does or doesn't do. At least that's the perception that I would get based on the kind of support.
Yeah, I think it would depend on what that other party would do and how they would support the issues that I just described, right?
Yeah.
And again, it's not that, you know, the issue, I want to make the issue or try to explain it clearly, that there's a prioritization, a hierarchy of issues where something like the minimum wage would rank like infinitely lower than something like, you know, protecting innocent life. It's just, it's not even in the same universe. So if I may want the minimum wage, or I may want the tax plan, or I may want the environmental protections, but we're against the more fundamental stuff, it's hard for me to get around supporting that party or supporting that individual.
Yeah, and I think that's the case for everything, right? Like, you always have, like, what are the core issues that a group represents or supports? The thing that I find really interesting here, and what this is really speaking to, is the degree that the Republican Party organizes itself against mm-hmm. prioritizing the issues that are most important to very religious, you know, people. Is that a winning strategy or a losing strategy going forward? Right. I think that's a really interesting. In some ways, you could say a winning strategy, because while it may be a smaller group, it's a much more focused group where they really would only vote on that.
Vote more often.
We're just going to support this. So you can say, like, that's going to keep you. And I think that's, in some cases, it's probably the example of what Trump was able to tap into and why you have such strong loyalists that are there. But if you fast forward another 10 years, another 15 years, if this trend continues, which again, there is nothing to indicate that trend is going to turn around.
Right.
How does that, you know, what does that mean for the party then?
But I think that there's a lot of cynicism though in that kind of thinking, right? That, like, is it the right strategy to continue to align yourself with people who are more religious? I would say that more people on the conservative side of the spectrum are themselves more focused on something transcendent, more believe in God. So they want to find the places where they feel themselves to belong more. In other words,
sure.
I could also make the case, by the way, another movement in the Democratic Party for the last 50, 60 years has been objectively, like, just moving away from things like organized religion, right? In fact, it was a debate years ago to actually just remove the word God entirely from the Democrat platform. So if I'm a religious person, if I'm a person who believes in God, like, that says a lot to me and says, moreover, you're not welcome here. That's one of the things that it says here.
I don't disagree with that, Charlie. Yeah. But I think that's part of the challenge that you have here, right? I mean, you still have a separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. So it's also not entirely crazy to have political parties that don't necessarily align themselves with the church. Right?
Of course.
And it is, those are the two camps that people are actually kind of picking, right? One, and that, by the way, that's also the same problem that the Democrats had. We've talked about this, is you have such a broad range of who consider themselves Democrat. Those that are conservative, those that are very liberal, or even like the, when people talk about the far left. And then there is a much harder group to please because you can have a lot of different people that hit a lot of different categories. And on the Republican side, you have this, what seems to be a much more concentrated, you know, group of folks. I just find it really interesting if that's the sort of orientation. What is that? It still works right now for the Republican Party because there's enough of them there. But it is interesting when you look at those stats of how much has decreased, what that then looks like. And that's kind of what I'm speaking to. What it looks like as you go forward, right?
I think the irony is that the Republican Party over the last 5 or 6 years has become much more in marketing or in actual practice trying to align themselves with the working class. That's the ironic part of it. So if there's some way that they survive or grow, it's because they're successful in that strategy. And the
that's a great marketing, right? Because when you look at policy, like I have a hard time understanding that point. It is good marketing because mm-hmm. they definitely like, oh, the big liberal. And to some extent, look, liberals have done it to themselves as well. Let's be honest, right? There's plenty of the, you know, corporate involvement with big tech, which
big
is part
tech,
of the
huge.
Huge,
not a
right?
Single
so
conservative
there's a lot there to pick from, right? Yeah. But I do find it interesting. You know, we're talking currently about, you know, raising minimum wage, right? Mm-hmm. A policy that most Republicans are completely against. This mm-hmm. is very – who would it impact? Exactly working class, right? There's big pushback against any kind of sort of national programs for healthcare. Who does that primarily impact or benefit? Working class. But yet, from positioning and also because the Democratic Party has not helped themselves in that category – It's one that they could make more of that claim. I agree with you.
Yeah. But it doesn't impact the working class in necessarily a vacuum in all those cases, right? So like the traditional argument for the minimum wage against it would be to say a lot of the employers the bulk of the employers in the country are small and medium-sized businesses.
Sure.
If you demand a higher wage increase rather than other areas to focus on, then what you do is you push a lot of those small mid-sized businesses to innovate their way into efficiency away from those lower skilled jobs. Like the classic example is the fast food robots, right? Which are actually a thing. They actually are developed and they're, you know, so
there's the little kiosk that you get in the fast food restaurants.
The little kiosk, that's already there. It's like that eliminates all those jobs and you'd much rather have a robot doing hamburgers than you would have a whole, you know, 16-year-olds doing hamburgers.
Yeah,
so what I'm saying is what do you say to that kind of argument?
It's always the same two arguments. Look, the same two arguments about like are that the ones that take the brunt of this are going to be small businesses. And the second one,
saying the brunt of it are going to be those same people. Yeah, the same people are going to be the brunt.
But it's both, right? It's the small business take the brunt, and therefore result of that is people losing their jobs. And then the second one would be is that by doing any of these programs, which is the one I was speaking to, is that you're increasing the debt and that your grandchildren are going to be paying for this debt, which that second one, by the way, goes out the window. The second banks need that help. Right,
I so think like that one goes or out big the company, window for everyone because like we just nobody like, seems to care about the debt, neither party. So
it's just, and I just don't fully buy it. And by the way, the thing about the raise in minimum wage is also no one has ever brought it up as like, hey, tomorrow it's going to raise by whatever it is. You know, it's always a gradual process.
Sure.
With less people actually be able to adjust to it.
Yeah,
and you're still going to be impacted by globalization. You're still going to have all the issues of which you know jobs you know end up going to other places if you don't innovate. So I don't know if at the end of the day you really are sort of saving these businesses if they're not really innovative to begin with.
By the way, can I tell you some of the funny things that I liked about this article and then we can move on?
Yes.
Just some of the things where you could tell that the author just didn't have a lot of facility for this subject matter. Maybe, who knows, maybe they're super religious and just wrote a goofy article. I don't know. But there's some little things like when she's the writer is quoting Franklin Graham, who's an evangelist, son of a famous pastor.
Oh, yeah.
And
he wrote about
those who voted for impeachment. He said, quote, "It makes you wonder what the 30 pieces of silver were that Speaker Pelosi promised for this betrayal."
Yeah.
And then the writer says, as an aside, the author of this piece says, "In the metaphor, the Republican descenders are cast as Judas, who is said to have betrayed Jesus."
Who
is said to have. I'm like, well, you know, it's actually pretty historically documented, 2,000 years in history.
It is said to have, you know.
Well, yeah.
Technically, it's correct.
It is, but we've got, you know, something like 200 times the manuscript evidence of we do for things that Plato said or Aristotle said. But we wouldn't said Plato was said to have, you know, talked about the Platonic physics or whatever. Or actually, it was Aristotle.
Who has been reported to.
Reported to. So, like, little things like that, right?
I love that. I didn't catch that, but I would have laughed if I had noticed
I caught those. The other one was that he identifies as Christian. That kind of phraseology is really foreign to Christians. Like, you're not – I don't identify as a Christian. I am a Christian. You know what I mean? I believe in Christ. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
you know what I
mean? I mean, all right. I give – the other one's funnier. I give a little bit more of a pass because it's not such – like, you could –
I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just saying that it shows, like, a little bit of distance with the subject matter. You know what I mean? Identifying as Christian kind of places in the same kind of – political realm of the things that we're talking about. I think it transcends that.
Well, but I guess if I'm going to try to defend it, here's the way I would defend it, which is to say that you are Christian is also very, like, to me, no doubt in my mind that you are.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me to say that unless you can say that. It's hard for me to say that, right? So as me as an individual, I could say I am Christian versus I identify as Christian. But if I'm talking about another person, to say with 100% confidence, with 100% certainty, not confidence, certainty, you can say identify. Look, I'm trying to give a little bit of pass.
Context is everything. The piece is about him being a born again Christian. How much more evidence do you need?
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
So called.
Yeah, Judas was said to have been. Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be. Look, I think in everything that we talked about, we don't tend to talk about the impact that religion has. I think one place definitely to look at is that how interwoven those two things are, mm-hmm. evangelical Christians and Trump and Trumpism, to the degree that impacts and continues to influence the Republican Party going forward. I think it will be really interesting to track to see what the actual impact will be, to the degree that it welcomes more people who are being shunned or don't feel like there's a home for them in the Democratic side, or the opposite, shuns those that would otherwise be Republican but feel that it's too narrowly speaking to a very small, so everyday smaller sub-segment of what represents or should represent the Republican Party.
Yeah. I also think it's tragic, last point, in total agreement with him, with Kinzinger, on the fact that his assessment of it doesn't seem that policy actually matters. It's whether or not you support Trump or you don't.
Yeah.
That kind of litmus test is unhealthy no matter who the person is, no matter what the circumstance is, in terms of defining your entry into a party. That's one of the reasons why I'm so against some of the things that I've seen in terms of are you pro-choice or not, because that's a, you know, not to open up that can of worms again, but it seems to be you'd be very lonely as a pro-life Democrat. And that's, I don't like those litmus tests. And I think that I don't like them in this case and I don't like them in the other case either.
Yeah, I think on that topic, frankly, anytime, that's why I have a hard time with singular topics that define entire group. I think even that one, right, regardless of where you are. But I agree with you. I think if you are pro-life in a Democratic side, it's a lonelier place, because the reality is I think a lot of people are more in the camp of being pro-choice. It's just mm-hmm. kind of where we are. But it speaks to the same issue that we're talking about here. And but in any case, I don't want to belabor the point.
All right. Let's go on to Courage or Cringe, some lighter fare.
Yep.
We actually go across the pond for this first one. I haven't talked about the Premier League in a long time. Somebody, athlete there got himself into some hot water.
Lyle Taylor, a professional soccer player, and I said soccer player just to not confuse people. It's a footballer, as they call him there, from Nottingham Forest, or Forest as the team is often referred to.
Yep.
By the way, just because I'm my own ignorance, this is the same Nottingham Forest that they referred to in Robin Hood, right? Or no? Is it inspired by? Isn't this called Nottingham Forest? Or no? Am I making that up?
The something of Nottingham. Yeah. The I don't know.
First thing that
I want to say, one is probably fictional.
Well, I would think so. But I was just wondering if it was related to that.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm digressing here.
Sheriff of Nottingham. That's what it was. The Sheriff of Nottingham was the guy who Robin Hood was against.
But they live in Nottingham Forest. Because they live in the forest.
Yeah, it was. I mean, look, it's a fictional work, but maybe it's the same Nottingham.
Maybe he's referenced. That's very cool.
I honestly don't know.
We're going to say that it is because it sounds cool.
We're going to go
with that.
I like that.
So Lyle Taylor, once again, in an interview with a British morning show, said enough was enough and will refuse to take a knee at matches after branding the Black Lives Matter movement a Marxist group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and to quote, he said, "I took the decision because I felt that enough was enough. None of people have looked into the organization that has brought this all to the fore. Now, I said before that I agree with the message that Black lives do matter and something needs to be done about that to actually address the racial inequality and the societal injustice needs to stop. But by the same token, we are hanging our hat on a Marxist group who are simply looking to defund the police. They're looking to use societal unrest and racial unrest to push their own political agenda. And that's not what Black people are. We're not a token gesture or a thing to hang your movement on just because it's what's powerful and what's going on at the moment. He was also then asked about white footballers appreciating that they're taking part of this, to which Mr. Taylor said no. He continued, I also feel sorry for them. He's talking about white footballers. On the other hand, who even if they knew and agreed with what I'm saying and what other Black players mm-hmm. are saying, they cannot take the knee.
Yeah.
They cannot take the knee, right? They cannot, as a white player, cannot stand there and say, I'm not taking the knee because of this or that, because they were branded as racist. So
mm-hmm.
there's more to talk about this, but why don't we pause there? And encourage or cringe, obviously, and this one is specifically to the comments that that Lyle Taylor said in this interview. Do you see them as courageous, as cringeworthy?
We haven't identified the fact that Lyle Taylor's Black, right? So you haven't said that, or did you?
I did not say that, no. Okay. So yeah, he's Black. And I frankly did a quick search to see what his like roots are, and I just couldn't figure out.
I don't either. But
I think he's Black.
No, he definitely is. So yeah, look, for this one, you have to kind of break things down and look at exactly what he's saying, and then at least if that's what we're actually judging is his statement, right?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing to judge in this mm-hmm. case is his statement and his stance, and I think also basically using that as a moment to call out this organization.
And apparently this happened earlier too. I guess like he said something in January, but then he had an interview on their
I didn't see the earlier
version
piece,
of ABC or right. whatever. So this has like been an ongoing kind
it's
of
been
thing.
An ongoing thing, yeah. And yeah. there's a lot of history here, so I do want to talk about some of the history in the European leagues, but I don't want to belabor the point and kind of start getting your take on this.
Yeah, look, I'll start with the end in mind. I put it in the courage category for a couple of reasons. One is in kind of dissenting voices, as I brought up in the past, I think are healthy to the argument, and so we need to have some of those. And so I, sort of automatically have a bias to people who are dissenters. The second thing is that we have to look at what he actually said, and what he's saying is that, at least from what I can see, he's claiming that the BLM organization, and oftentimes in our conversations, we don't separate Black Lives Matter as a whatever, rallying cry, a form of protest, a statement of social justice from an actual organization that's called Black Lives Matter, because mm-hmm. both of those things are true.
Right. From a movement and from the organization, basically.
The movement from the organization, correct. Right. And I think what he's saying, and he's saying it, I think, really clearly, is that as it relates to the organization, you have to realize that this organization, I mean, he calls it Marxist. I don't know if you can call the entire organization Marxist, but you can definitely say that the founders, at least two of the three, I don't know which one, Alicia Garza or Patrice Cullors, I always forget. I know for sure Alicia Garza is one, but I don't know if it's Patrice Cullors or the other woman, Opal Tometi. But two of the three for sure have, and even have on their bios, they're Marxist. That's how they would define themselves or identify as. So in that regard, he is accurate in saying what he's saying. And so, it's truth in that regard. I also think what he says about the white players, it really made me think, like, okay, well, let's think about this. Let's play this out. If the white players, and I don't follow Nottinghamshire or whatever this is in the Premier League, but presumably all of them are taking a knee. They're all doing a knee at the beginning of the game.
Like, yeah.
And he's saying, if you're the white player, you can't not take a knee.
Right.
And I really thought about that, and I'm like, well, you know what? Of course, physically they could stand, but the point he's making is it would be really bad for you if you did that, right?
Sure.
And I have to agree with him, just on the basis of what I read in these articles, that it probably would be viewed extraordinarily negative if anybody had any issue, like he seemingly does, with the organization and decided to not take a knee at that moment in protest of that. It would be very bad for them at a level perhaps that far outweighs how bad it is for this guy, Lyle Taylor. So, because of what he said, and because of the sort of rationale for doing it, I come down on courage, you know, and I know they've since deleted a lot of this stuff from the BLM site, but there was a time when they specifically were, they were much more clear about the Marxist roots and about, mm-hmm. you know, some of the goals that they have about the nuclear family and, you know, things that are Western civilization prescribed. And there's a bunch of different things. They've changed all that on their website. I'm not sure if they ever explained why, but on the basis of all of those factors, I come down on cringe for this guy. I'm sorry, on courage for this guy saying what he said.
Yeah. And I would say as a starting point, I mean, this is the challenging part when you have a movement in an organization that have the exact same name, right?
Right.
And I think, I mean, I would hope that people would you know, maybe agree with this, with the statement that if you could do it over again, you could have those be two separate things. The movement be called one thing, or organization be called something else.
So like all Black Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter.
Whatever. Like, and yeah. It doesn't even matter to me what the name is. I mean, it's just to have two different names. And the reason why I think it would be important is because it creates these kind of moments like this where if I give someone the full benefit of the doubt, it makes it hard for someone to say, I really disagree with this organization, but I really agree with this movement. But how do I support one without the other when they like literally call the same thing?
And they're so intricately linked, though. It's not right. just that they're to give them, disparate.
Yeah, but you could still have them very linked and still be two separate things. And I still think that will be better.
Yeah.
But it also creates a great excuse, right, on the other side of people to basically say, hey, I don't support this because of the organization, and completely ignore the whole movement or the reason why people are protesting, all the issues that are currently there.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's also a problem. Once again, so I think there was a way to a do-over. I would rather just see them just a little bit different names just so you can be able to more clearly identify one versus the other, mm-hmm. right? Now, in this case, there was two main reasons why mm-hmm. when looking at this topic, I came under cringe, right? And the reason I came under cringe was twofold. One is I totally can respect and appreciate Lyle Taylor's comments and his point of view of not wanting to support the organization. That's fine. We may not agree, but he has 100% right to do that. What is not clear to me, and maybe mm-hmm. there was another thing that we just didn't do enough research to find out, is that if he is actually supportive of the movement, it's not clear at all that he's doing anything to support the movement to replace the taking a knee.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If he comes out and say, hey, by the way, I'm not going to take a knee because we're not that so interlinked with this organization, Black Lives Matter, which I disagree with for all the reasons. Having said that, I really strongly believe in what it's trying to present, and therefore I'm going to do this. If those comes out at the same time, I'm like, that's kind of cool. Like, that's great. You know what? Because we don't all have to sort of support it in the exact same way. I think it's fine to do whatever that extra thing is or the different thing is. I think that would have been gone a long, long way of really coming across clearly of his support for the movement or the importance of it while creating some arm length separation between the actual organization. And the second is that when you think about everything's in context, right? In the context of where he plays, right? The European League has been plagued with racism over years and years. I didn't know this, but I doing my research, I found out that apparently last October, there was a new protocol that was put in by the UEFA, which is the European soccer governing body, right? That allows referees to stop play if racist behavior continues after two warnings issued by a stadium announcer. Before I even say anything else, the fact that you even had to put in a protocol for gameplay to stop play because of additional racism, you know, you have a massive problem. It's been like widely reported. Black players, in this case, they could be from anywhere. Being called monkeys, throw bananas at them,
all kinds of racial taunts. Players that play in the Premier League or in Serie A or in La Liga.
But it's not just that; it's also
is.
Players that work for that are from Britain.
Oh, for sure, there are actual native born Black players. But I'm saying it seems to, at least from my experience, come up when there's also a national component to it.
Happens in a national component for sure. They were talking about a specific incident that happened between a game between England and I forget who the second team was, but basically where the English players, some of the Black English players, were being taunted, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of what I'm speaking to. Like the second year, even that has to be part of a protocol to put in place is, you know, you have a massive issue. So you're a league that has really struggled with racism. Clear racism within your games, which is not something that for all of the issues that NFL, you know, NBA, all of none of it here ever happens, at least not to that degree, right? Maybe a little more subtle. You still have racism, of course, but not to that degree. And I think for him, who is a Black player, I would just love to see a little bit more of, fine, you don't agree with the organization, okay, that's fine. You could disagree with them. You think they're Marxists? Fine. I could even argue with you a little bit about that, but fine. It doesn't matter. What do you want to do instead, right? Or maybe your thing is like, this is not that important to me, because that's kind of what it sounds to me a little bit more. The part where I get it, but I don't know what the solve is about some of the white players that are there, but maybe there is also the same thing, which is if those come out with, hey, this is how we want to show support in a very public manner. We're not going to shy away from it. And this is how we're doing it because we have some issues with the organization. I think it'll still be hard for them to basically shun the organization if they're white. But I would rather see that, I think, come out a little bit more proactively. And then that feels like a moment of courage that even if you don't agree with an organization, you feel that this move is important enough, especially because you happen to play in a sport in an area of the world that just really deals with a lot of racism on the field.
Okay, that's fair. I think that's actually pretty reasonable. I don't know what he did or didn't do.
Yeah, I didn't see it. Maybe he did, and I don't know that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I also do think that, you know, that could also, even though I think it's reasonable personally, I can understand how something like that could be taken by people to mean if I have to now satisfy some quotient of whatever, you know what I mean, activism relative to this cause, rather than me just disagree or not want to. Now I have to prove my disagreement by doing something other than this to satisfy whoever is in charge.
Then say the truth. Hey, you know what? I'm not an activist. I don't care for it. Like, I understand it's important. Other people will do that. That's not what I play football. That's what I do.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that could be.
Then say that, because then that's what you really mean.
Right.
And that's okay.
Right.
Right. But you're going to get, you know, a little bit of hell for that as well. But then say that. Be honest about it. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, no, I really believe in this movement and the, you know, all this need, but I'm so opposed to this organization, therefore I'm not going to do that.
Right, right. And I do think that, because I read some of the pieces about the arguments on the Marxism stuff, and they tended to kind of gloss over at least the classical definitions of Marxism. But if you actually do, if this guy actually does believe that this organization is Marxist, and again, the founders have described themselves as Marxist, at least 2/3 of them. But that doesn't mean the organization is Marxist. But if he really does believe that, you know, Marxism was the sort of leading ideology behind these communist states that killed 100 million people. So, like, this is not something to take really lightly. If you really do believe that this is a Marxist organization, I can understand not wanting to, you know, take the knee. Again, to your point, he could have just simply said, you know, to been sort of honest and I'm not an activist, or shown some other way to do it, which is why you come down the way that you do. I guess I was just looking at it much more just based on what he said or didn't, you know, about the issue. Okay, cool. Cuomo brothers. Always fun topic.
Oh, yeah. Governor Cuomo, man. He's had quite a, you know, whatever it is now, 2.5 weeks. And look, this one's been covered obviously quite a bit already. And by the way, this I would categorize this as the most talked about, not talked about issue, depending on who you look at.
Right.
And the reason I say this is because when this started breaking, everywhere that I would see it, it would always be presented as, look, this is what the big media or what do they call it? Not general media. Like it's a big media is trying
mainstream media is trying
to cover up this scandal. But yet everyone was talking about it. I'm like, you know, something's not being talked about. It sure is being talked about a lot,
right?
Like on podcasts that, you know, I saw it in basically every publication has something about this, right?
Right.
So anyways, so to get into...
I'll make a comment on that later.
Okay, to get into this specific take on it, right? So look, we all know there was a big controversy with Governor Cuomo and the way that they handled during the sort of the heat of the pandemic response, some of the reporting on people that actually died within these care homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the number was like about
nursing homes.
Nursing home, thank you. It was like 15,000 that were actually passed away, as opposed to 8,500 what they actually reported, right? And the fallout has been sort of pretty tremendous across the board, right? Both Democrat and Republican state legislators have spoken out against the governor, calling for his emergency powers to be stripped and an investigation to be opened over his handling of the pandemic. They're now also facing potential federal probe. He's also now being accused, this is Cuomo, of threatening Democratic Assemblyman Ron Kim. That was a big one that came out last week. Also been another three legislators who also told CNN that the governor and his staff had been threatening those who were considered voting in favor of stripping Cuomo of his emergency powers, which sort of speaks to this pattern of him like really bullying people. And it really is a major fall from grace for someone that, and this is, I cringe when I first saw this.
The Emmy?
No, when he wrote a book in October of last year, which was called, and I quote, American Crisis, leadership lessons from the COVID-19 pandemic. Like, dude, you're in the middle of it. What are you talking about?
Can I ask a really dumb question? When the heck do you have the time to write a book?
Exactly. Like, when do you have the time to write it? You're in it right now.
You're in it. You're writing your own. Yeah.
It's like, you know, Tom Brady writing a best, you know, bestseller of winning the Super Bowl in the third quarter.
In the
third quarter. You're in the third quarter. The game's not over.
That's so true.
And that was like, oh my God, right? Like, this is just, in any case. But the other major issue that came up, you know, as part of this, and it started to come up more and more, is how that conflict of interest in the media coverage, especially by CNN, may have contributed to this, right? So CNN themselves is also facing criticism for its coverage of Governor Cuomo, with experts saying that the network committed a major blunder by allowing his brother, Chris Cuomo, to regularly interview him on his show, Cuomo Primetime, right? Now, CNN already confirmed that it has reinstated a prohibition on Cuomo interviewing or doing stories about his brother.
Which the prohibition had existed before. They lifted it.
They lifted it, right? They lifted it during the pandemic as the governor appeared on Chris Cuomo's show about 9 times between March and June. So it's a lot of coverage, right? Now, according to a spokesperson from CNN, they said, and I quote, "The early months of the pandemic crisis were an extraordinary time. We felt that Chris speaking to his brother about the challenges of what millions of American families were struggling with was of significant human interest. As a result, we made an exception to a rule that we had in place since 2013, which prevents Chris from interviewing and covering his brother, and that rule remains in place today." So, look, there's a lot to unpack about Governor Cuomo, and a lot of it has been talked about already. But, you know, as we think about courage or cringe, you know, there is, I think, this dynamic that, was there a greater good of allowing Chris Cuomo to interview his brother? And what, you know, ended up becoming these very sort of heartfelt conversations that, frankly, I watched every one of them. Like, I'll be the first to admit on this one. Look, when this was going on, and maybe I could roll right into my position here, I think, because I'm still trying to work it out.
Go ahead.
When this was coming out, I watched religiously the updates of Governor Cuomo, right? Like, it was literally the only update. I wouldn't watch Newsom, because they were always way too long and rambly. President Trump at the time, it was just a shit show, frankly, right? Like, someone will come up and say something, he'll get up there and immediately contradict what they're saying. And it was like this, like, who's on first, who's on second kind of dynamic. So, like, that, I saw one and, like, no value here whatsoever. Governor Cuomo's daily briefings were excellent. He always started with the facts, is what he called it. And they would just tell the good about it. Here's exactly where we are. Here's exactly where we were yesterday, like, day by day. Here's what we're doing, and kind of get into every day what they're doing, right? I mean, in any ways, it felt, in a time of a lot of uncertainty, really reassuring to see that there was at least some kind of plan, accountability, at least in tracking what was happening. That's always my issue with Governor Newsom, is that while the data was there, they were never really that great about sharing it on a daily basis. And these guys were. Daily basis, they were showing. Now, it turns out that not all the data. Turns out that not all the data, but at least in terms of how they were reporting it. Or you can say, well, there was obviously some portion of it holding it back. But but in part, I think they probably are a little bit situation where they can get called out more because they release so much data on such a frequent basis. When I look at Newsom, when I look at other folks, it was much harder to figure out what exactly was going on. You had to sort of look at different sources. And it was very comforting, frankly, to see that. At least there was some kind of game plan. And then seeing this dynamic in a moment where I think many of us were sitting here struggling with losing some of those personal relationships, being able to, like, hang out with family, friends, et cetera. And seeing, frankly, as myself, who I have an older brother, who many times will go times where we don't talk a lot, and then we talk a lot. But, you know, we have our moments. And it was nice to see that brotherly love. I mean, there was times where I saw that, and I would text my brother. Like, because, you know, I feel like he's older than me, and we, you know, just hadn't talked to him in a few days. I would just text him. So there was a lot of really good feel moments about this. Sure. So I see.
So you struggled all with the value decision of this. On the basis of all of that.
I see all the value. And I see a lot of value for having given him that airtime. At the same time, when you come down to it and you see the role that Governor Cuomo had and his own personal decisions, not just of the act, but the trying to cover it up, after he put out this book in the middle of a pandemic that's still happening. And, like, I have a really hard time then coming back and then defending it.
Yep.
Because as much as I can look back in a way that maybe you forget about the little issues, and he's always had a reputation of being kind of a bully anyways, right? I come down on cringe on this one when it all comes down to it, even though I have a lot of very good fond memories of that. And I think there was a lot of good that actually came of that. And it felt like what was exactly needed in a time of a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah. So you're cringe.
I'm still cringe, yeah. Wow. Despite all the tee up, I still lost to
the tee up and the heartbreak. And
the
you're tee still
up
there.
And heartbreak and still cringe because of what it is.
I think the thing for me is what the expectation is of people watching that show that makes this a cringe for me as well. And that is that I think most people that tune into that show, and you tell me if I'm wrong, I've only seen clips. I've never actually watched an entire show. I think the expectation is that people are actually getting primetime news.
Yeah, not only that, but also Chris Cuomo, his reputation, in my opinion, is the one that would ask hard questions.
Sure.
That you go on there, you're gonna you know, be ready to bring it because you're going to get some tough questions, you're going to beat up a little bit. And it's exactly what you want and need from a guy like him in that kind of show.
So on the basis of that expectation that you're expecting news, it seems to me that making a decision to create this amazing kind of feel-good exchange between brothers that made you want to text your brother and all that is really awesome, that should be a separate show and call it something else, not under the auspices of a new show. And I think ultimately that's how these guys get in trouble. That's the reason why the original moratorium, if it was, about him interviewing his brother, existed since 2013, which they chose for an editorial reason not to enforce, which bit them in the butt, which they've now since reinforced. So for me, it's clear.
Right.
They had a policy for reasons that you want in a new show to not have your brother interview your brother or brother interview a brother. They broke with that because they thought it'd make good television at this moment where the country's going through all this stuff. But because they're probably pretty funny and charismatic with each other and it could help ratings, don't think for a second that wasn't part of it.
Oh, it was great. I'm sure. Great television. It really was.
I'm sure. And, look, I've tried hard, very hard, to not like Chris Cuomo. I like Chris Cuomo. I actually do.
I like him as well.
I think he's sharp. He's funny. I don't believe for a second he can dumbbell press a 100-pound barbell over his head like he did with that styrofoam thing that he was holding that one time. Not for a second, because I actually know what it feels like to lift a 100-pound dumbbell.
Separate courage or cringe, Charlie.
I know it is. But I actually do like him. I think he's smart. I think he's very charismatic. I think he's a good man. This is cringe for those reasons.
You know, I think what makes it even more cringe, Charlie, is that because of that, all that airtime and coverage they were getting on the Chris Cuomo show, is that he wasn't getting that time and that scrutiny on the other CNN shows.
For sure.
So Jake Tapper has come out since saying that, hey, we were trying to interview him forever. We kept on getting our interviews declined. He said, we've been trying to get, you know, Governor Cuomo on the air with us.
He's like turned us down a bunch of times.
But then you look at it, well, why would he have to? If he had a nice, more friendly version to go on and get his message out. And I also think, by the way, part of the fault, and this is where, you know, you and I have debated about the role the media plays. The media definitely played a role here in the fact that there was also the dynamic happening between when it was such a screw-up from President Trump that it was in some ways easy to find that counterbalance of accountability, at least of some kind of plan of coming like, hey, these are the facts. Once again, it turns out the facts weren't entirely correct, but
it's at least half the facts.
Right, at least half of them. But it was very much like, we're going to take it in the chin. This is what we're going to do. This is like the game plan. Compared to what just felt like a complete, like trying to gloss it over, this is just going to go away. And it was also very easy to to turn Governor Cuomo into the hero of the moment because there was such a lack of leadership, at least in the White House. And I think the media really added to that as well.
Last point before we get on to what's going on in the state of Oregon. The point that you made about, you know, if this thing has been concealed, it seems to be everywhere. In fairness, I think most of that commentary was about when this was happening back in May and June of last year.
That it took so long for it to
come out. That a lot of people were saying, this is happening, where is it? And nobody was talking about it. I don't think anybody, at least that I've seen, is saying that nobody's talking about it now.
The Hill was like all over this.
Yeah.
They were all over saying that it wasn't being talked about now. And I was like, this is ridiculous.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting for them, I guess.
Yeah.
Even more so.
It was funny, though, because you see it and then like literally everyone was talking about it. And I agree. Like this one kind of picked up some steam. Like all of a sudden it went from like, what happened?
Right.
Like there was the Zoom call where someone rolled this out and then
there was definitely
it was like a little avalanche started to get created.
When all of this first went down in chronology, not in this time piece, but when the actual nursing home stuff was going down in real time, there was a lot of like, oh, this is conspiracy. This is Trump trying to make something out of Cuomo's awesome handling of the initiative.
Well, we didn't get into that, but yeah, I mean, look, the reason why they held the information is they basically admitted to saying this. They were concerned. They were getting prosecuted and that they were going to give
Trump a bunch of ammo too.
For sure, right?
Yeah, so this is really
so
bad.
They were concerned about a potential federal investigation, right, by the Department of Justice. That was their concern, which is frankly extremely wrong. We look at how many deaths specifically happened in these nursing homes, of which once again, if there was, like, there's no doubt in my mind that there was any, like, ill intent of trying to have more people die. Like, I don't think that was the case at all.
Yeah, do I.
But you make a bad mistake even worse by trying to cover it up. And then the reasons for not sharing information, I think, are pretty terrible.
All right. Oregon. The Pacific Northwest. What could go wrong?
Pacific Northwest. Yeah, nothing ever happens over there. Nothing. Beautiful, beautiful.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful state, by the way. So the Oregon Department of Education, or ODE as they go by, recently encouraged teachers to register for training that encourages ethnomathematics. An ODE newsletter sent last, it was last week, advertises a February 21st Pathway to Math Equity microcourse, which was designed for middle school teachers to make use of a toolkit for dismantling racism in mathematics, right? Now, the ODE communications director, Mark Siegel, he defended this equitable math plan or educational program, saying that it helps educators learn key tools for engagement, development strategies to improve equitable outcomes for Black, Latinx, and multilingual students, and joins communities of practice, Now, the program gets into, just to speak a little bit about what the program actually is, it gets into how white supremacy culture shows up in mathematics. And it has a bunch of different categories, but I'll just cover a couple of them. One is engaging and supporting all students. As a subcategory, is a focus on getting the right answer, and right is in quotes. Independence practice values over teamwork or collaboration. Also within the category of creating and maintaining effective environments for learning, it says teachers enculturated in the USA teach math the way they learned it, right? In terms of assessing students for learning, the students required to show their work. And there is a whole piece of what they talk about, what that means, right? It's more about helping the teachers understand what the thought process of the students, as opposed to the students themselves learning it. Grading practices that are focused on lack of learning. So it's a bunch of the different ways of which they describe white supremacy culture, once again, is influenced mathematics. And as a result of that, the program itself basically creates a curriculum or a guidance in terms of how teachers can become anti-racist math educators, right? And there's a couple of things that we'll just cover real quickly. One is to design a culturally sustainable math space. So as part of that, they say to use culturally relevant anti-racist pedagogy, practices, and curriculum to cultivate mathematical identity so that everyone can see themselves as mathematicians, to adapt homework policies to fit the needs of students of color. That's probably a good one to click into. Also creating a center of ethnomathematics, right, to teach that mathematics can help solve problems affecting students' communities, model the use of math as a solution for their immediate problems, needs, or desires. And then other areas include prepare students of color to close the gap in access to STEM fields, which STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, and then support students to reclaim their mathematical ancestry. Now, so this is all what it does. Now, of course, this, by the way, is a piece that we were reading was part of coverage from Fox News. So there were some references within the toolkit that were, you know, pretty controversial. And this is not necessarily within the toolkit, but it's the toolkit references this other piece, workbook called Dismantling Racism, which it says that it builds on. But that other piece, Dismantling Racism, had a couple of things that it brought up. One, in one section of this workbook, the argument is made that only white people can be racist in our society because only white people as a group have that power. By the way, completely disagree with that statement. Just I'll give you my piece there. Another section seems to justify anti-cop sentiments, right? And in quote, said, in some cases, the prejudices of oppressed people, you can't trust the police, are necessary for survival. Also seem to take some anti-capitalist tone, right? And in quotes, says, we cannot dismantle racism in a system that exploits people for private profit. If you want to dismantle racism, then we must build a movement for economic justice. That particular workbook was created by a group called dismantlingracism.org. Now, once again, that book, workbook, is not within the toolkit that we talked about.
It's referenced in it, yeah.
It's just referenced in it.
Right.
But, of course, the article that we read from Fox News, basically most of the arguments that it was making against it was actually talking about that workbook, not necessarily what was included in this this toolkit. So, Charlie.
Oh, man. You know what? I was never really good at math. You know that I know you're an engineer, so you laugh when
I
say something like that.
I was pretty good at math, yeah.
I'm sure you're pretty good at math. I was never really good at math. I failed algebra a bunch of times. I used to always joke that the right side of my brain was the only one that was developed and the left side just atrophied at like 3 or 4 years old. So I could talk a good game, but I couldn't do an equation. I really appreciate and love the idea of mathematics. I love the concept of a language that, you know, people can speak, you know, even though they may not speak the same tongue or idiom, but they share the language in common. I get all the beauty of physics. I've read all the Alan Lightman books on Einstein. Like, I get all that. It sounds beautiful, but I've never really liked mathematics. And after reading this piece, I like math even less. That's the bottom line. Look, there's a lot of things in here
that's funny.
In this article that are noble. The idea of like trying to close the gap with STEM,
sure.
The idea of people being able to visualize themselves, or at least the potential that they could be great mathematicians or whatever. Mm-hmm. Awesome. The more we can do that, phenomenal. But then I come across this statement and the entire thing just fall like the crater opened up and the earth swallowed everything with it. And
which statement?
This is the statement coming up here. And it's from the document for equitable math from the toolkit.
Okay.
It says the concept of mathematics being purely objective is unequivocally false. And then it went on to say, quote, upholding the idea that there are always right and wrong answers in mathematics, that emphasis mine because it's not in the quote, but that's what we're talking about, perpetuate objectivity as well as fear of open conflict. Okay, this is what's called in philosophical circles as a self-refuting statement, okay? Mm-hmm. The fact that there is nothing, that mathematics is not objectively true, or that there is nothing that is objectively true, cannot itself be true because you've just taken objective truth away. So that includes your statement. But look, what I remember of math, and again, I wasn't very good at it, Jesus, so you might have to remind me, but I do remember that things were either were unequivocally false or unequivocally so in the case of mathematics. Equations are either wrong or they're wrong or they're right. Now, the idea of if this person meant, talk about giving the benefit of the doubt, if this person meant that the concept of mathematics being purely objective is false, and in that they meant the way mathematics is taught, I don't know, the languages we use for mathematics as a broad concept, but like maybe I could see that. But the idea that mathematical equations or algorithms or whatever it is that you're, whatever it is, coefficients and all the things that I don't know what they mean, but I know the words. All of those things that I remember are either true or they're not. That's what I remember about mathematics.
Yeah. It's interesting. So this one, so you're definitely cringe on this one.
Oh, did I not start with that? I'm sorry. My bad.
I'm cringe.
With a capital K.
Capital K. Yeah. I like that.
But largely based on that. And by the way, just one last thing, as I'll mention it just as an aside, because I really want to hear what you have to say. You're much more informed on mathematics than I am. I have the book here on the desk by Carter Woodson, who is the father of Black History Month. A lot of people may not know who he is, but he's a scholar and an academic, and he actually was kind of founded the precursor of what we now celebrate on February as Black History Month. But anyway, we have a lot of books of Carter Woodson in our house because we, for a number of years, homeschooled. And when Black History Month came around, we wanted to actually have books that were on the subject by experts and people who actually lived and founded that. So we had a lot of his books. And in it, he talks about some of the systemic stuff that he saw 100 years ago, which is like, hey, if it was about the natural sciences, we didn't really talk about a lot of the natural sciences that evolved from the African continent, right? The idea of being able to make poison-tipped arrows and the idea of being able to create color palettes from minerals and the idea of extracting iron to create, iron weapons. Like, we didn't hear about that. We heard about everything happening in other parts of the world. So I concede that there's a lot of those kind of systemic things in this. Mm-hmm. But this solve or whatever these folks are trying to do, on the basis of that single quote, I literally have to take the entire thing and throw it in the garbage just on the basis of that one quote, as far as I'm concerned, despite some of the things that are good that are going along with it. So that's me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. So, yeah, this is actually, it was one of the ones that it really stuck, got my attention when I first saw it. And there is a lot in this toolkit that just frankly, because it's, I don't know how many pages long, it's 82 pages, I just did not get a chance to read all of it, right? So there's a lot there, what they're saying, that I really can't speak to. That whole thing about focusing on the right answer, I can absolutely see why someone that reads it would have that immediate response that you just had, right? Like, look, if 2 + 2 = 4... And you're going to tell me, like, it's 4. Like, there is no, like, it could be 8 or it could be
5, yeah.
Right. Yeah. You could, and I understand that. I think the challenging, and it just all depends on how you look at this. The more complex math you go to, the less so black and white it becomes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, to your point, I had a little bit of the benefit of getting to the more complex sort of some sort of math where that the line of being sort of one thing or another It's not as.
But can I ask you? Is it because the line of how you get there is more evolved?
Yeah, that's what it is.
But when you get there, is it either
Is it either or not? Because it's the thing is because these are a lot of this is based on theorems, right? Mm-hmm. And the theorems are what they are until someone proves them that they're no longer the case. Mm-hmm. So some of it is like, this is, as far as we know, this is correct until someone proves it otherwise.
Gotcha.
And that's the kind of a little bit of the point that I'm trying to get to. Now, that's giving them also a lot of benefit of doubt. That's what they meant on here. But my interpretation, what I actually found really interesting, is that I do find it, I do think it's a little bit of a problem that there is so much focus on just the right answer and not enough of what is the process, the understanding of getting to that answer, right?
Sure.
And that's frankly what I took away when I was seeing this, because when they talk about the ways to solve for that, because they give like recommendations, one of them was saying, make it a verbal example. And the question they asked, what are some strategies we can use to engage with this problem? Right. So it's no longer about just simply saying 2 + 2 = 4, make it a word problem. It's like, how would you solve for that? What is the ways that you will go about doing it? And actually talk about that. And actually, that's one thing that, like, I find myself more and more recently with my daughter, like helping her sometimes with her math homework. Mm-hmm. And at that age, she's 8 years old, about to turn 9. It is very much, she just wants to get to the answer. It's like, great. So is the answer 5? Awesome. Let's move on. I'm like, no. You're going to explain to me how you got to the answer. Like, how will you do it? And we spent a lot of time actually talking about that. And the reason for me is super, especially word problem, because I was really confused initially. Because her orientation was that if there's a word problem, I'm going to pull out whatever are numbers and either divide, multiply, plus, like, does that sound right? Great. I'm like, well, how do you know? Why do you know it's division versus multiplication? Like, give me your logic behind it.
What is it that you're thinking? What's going on behind the scenes?
And I think that's super important. I'd rather her understand that than to get the right answer.
So what does that have to do with mathematics being racist, though?
No, so that's a separate point, right? So in terms of some of the things that they talk about here, right? Mm-hmm. That whole thing of just focusing on the right answer, I think there is merit of unpacking maybe the right answer and really understanding kids do better understanding the actual problem you're trying to solve.
I have no problem with that.
Part of the reason why I thought, not give myself a lot of kudos from when I was going to school and college is that I was pretty good at understanding the why of being able to derive the answer or derive the formula. It wasn't no longer about remembering the formula. All right. And I think that kind of thinking is really important. Even right now, like my daughter, she does divisions. Frankly, the fact that she can remember what 8 × 4 is really not relevant. It's whether she know when to apply it. That's the really important part, right? And that's really what we try to focus on. In this whole thing, when I looked at the actual things they're recommending, I thought it was some like really insightful things. The part that I had a hard time understanding is what is that connection to racism that they kept on bringing up, or to white supremacy, which is the other thing that they had on here, right? Am I getting that right? That I just did not understand.
Well, the inference would be at least and this may not be what they're saying, but the inference is that black and brown kids don't think that way, or that white kids only think that way. That has to be the inference.
I guess. And that, like, frankly, this is a case where I think when you look at the actual detail of the material, I think it's actually pretty useful, some of the stuff that they're saying here. There was very little that I looked at of what they were recommending that I had an issue with, that I actually think that if they apply, kids will have a stronger education, a better, like, being a better understanding. And actually, frankly, the teachers create a better dynamic. Even some of the things that they brought on here, look, having people to understand how to access STEM fields. Like, look, the only reason I studied engineering, look, my sister did that. I mean, I benefited from my sister being the one that did all the work to realize there was engineering. Mm-hmm. I never heard of the thing. Most of the time when I told people that I was studying mechanical engineering, people thought I was going to be a mechanic. That was the thing, like, and you know what? People were happy for me.
I don't mean to laugh, but that's...
People were so excited. They're like, oh, that's great. You're going to be a mechanic.
And you could be probably a really damn good mechanic. You could build a car, too, and be a good mechanic.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, I'm studying to be a mechanic engineer. You're like, oh, you're going to be a mechanic? That's awesome. And it wasn't like a knock for people.
No,
it wasn't like people were like very happy.
Sure.
But there was a complete lack of understanding to STEM fields that I literally only benefited because my sister happened to go into engineering school.
Sure.
And I think to do more of those things, to be proactive at that stage, to help close those gaps, it's a really good thing. All of that was great. The sort of starting point, and I think even phrasing it the way they are, or how racism drives this, is the one I just had a little bit of a harder time understanding, the direct connection. That to me, if you literally just take away that and apply a program like this in terms of what it's trying to create in terms of the kind of environment, I would have no issue whatsoever. A lot of it, at least for the parts that I read, like, seem like really, really smart in terms of what they're trying to do. But it was that that trying to make that direct connection to being the root cause of all these problems being racism is one that I just had a little bit of a hard time trying to understand.
So then?
So I'm on cringe because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I like the program. I think a lot of what they have here, frankly, if this something like this was at my daughter's school, I would have no problem whatsoever.
You're saying the way it was framed was
probably I just don't see it. I think this is a case of trying to force yet one other thing into the same kind of what's popular right now to make it sound cooler.
Very cool. And again, just to hype Carter Woodson, for anybody who is interested, the father of Black History Month, look up his story. I've got a bunch of his books. It's actually super interesting stuff. He's the second PhD from Harvard, by the way, ever in the school's history who was black. The first was W.E.B. Dubois, or Du Bois, depending on how you pronounce it. He started the celebration of Negro History Week, which then evolved in order to coincide with the birthdays of two actually Republicans, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. It became the whole month of February, and then in 1970, we got what we know today as Black History Month. But anyway, very, very, very thoughtful, very well-spoken, super interesting insights in a lot of the books by Carter Woodson, so check him out. Okay, Jesus, anything else?
So we were 2 out of 3.
That's pretty good.
Alignment?
That's pretty good today, I think. You know, coming back, we'll see. We're still longing for that perfect... that perfect 3 out of 3. We'll see if we get there. Did we? I don't know. I already forgot. See?
Thought we did it once.
All right. Anything else? Anything last words?
No.
We're good. All right, everybody. We'll see you then again next time on TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza, and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.